Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.
This is The Athletic Football Show.
Welcome to The Athletic Football Show. I'm Robert Mays. Really fun show for you guys. A little bit later in the show, Jeff Schwartz from Jeff Schwartz is Smarter Than You. He's on Sirius. He shows up a lot of different places. Former NFL offensive lineman. He's going to talk about what free agency is like for a player who's in demand. He told some really fun stories. Excited for you guys to hear that. Before we do that, though, joining me today is my good friend Lindsey Jones. Lindsey, how are you?
I'm good. Happy almost New Year, Robert. What if we did our real New Year's this way? Like we had 2 days leading into New Year's.
I really enjoy the fact that I screw up the free agent calendar every single year. We were going to do something on Wednesday because that's when free agency opens. I've only covered the NFL for like 7 years. So by now I should know that all of these deals were going to roll in on Monday. So we decided this morning, let's just go with it because it's been a really fun day of NFL news. I wanted to kind of add some urgency to the way we recapped it. So we're going to talk about some of the initial reports from the free agent signings that we've seen. As you guys know, this is live. It's 4:20 p.m. Central Time right now. So there might be some more. I mean, and reacting to them in real time is always really fun. So let's start with what you floated as, now I understand, is a joke way to start the podcast. As a dig at me. But you, as soon as the Joe Tooney signing happened, you said, this is how we're leading the show. I just assumed you were serious, but
I am serious.
Okay. So let's start with that. So
I am serious, but I also know that there is nothing in the world that you love more than some super sexy, hot interior offensive line play.
Well, you'd be surprised at my reaction to this then. So the Chiefs go out, they sign Joe Tooney of the Patriots, formerly of the Patriots, to a reported 5-year, $80 million deal with $32 million fully guaranteed and $48 million in practical guarantees because of an injury guarantee that kicks in next year. So this is shocking only in that a week ago, it just didn't feel like the Chiefs were going to financially be in the running for guys like this. But after cutting both of their starting tackles, they had some money to burn and they had to remake their offensive line. And they made a very, very splashy move. $16 million for Joe Tooney resets the guard market and gets another high-priced guy from outside Kansas City onto that roster to go along with guys like Tyrann Mathieu, Frank Clark. They have not been shy about taking big swings. This one is at a slightly less exciting position. Let's just say that much.
It is, but it's so necessary, right? I mean, I think when you looked at, you know, or when I was looking at the Chiefs heading into today and this week, they had to do something on the offensive line. I was kind of keeping my eye on Trent Williams, if that was a guy that they might try to make the really splashy play, because clearly there's a need for a left tackle there. But, you know, instead they went with Zeitler. You know, at this point, I'm not going to rule Veach and company, Veach and Andy Reid out of any sort of, you know, free agent market, any sort of position that they might want to go after. But you would think that this would take them out of the running for Trent Williams, who, you know, has not yet re-signed with San Francisco. I know the Niners were kind of hoping to get something done with him. But, you know, look, they, at this point, there was only one returning starter from the Chiefs Super Bowl win on that offensive line. And that was Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, whose name I always mispronounce, who didn't even play last year. This has been massive turnover on that entire offensive line. And we saw in the Super Bowl how badly they really need good offensive linemen. So they had to be aggressive. They had to spend a lot of money. I don't know if it's the best value deal that was out there. But when you look at a team that has needs and going out and getting the best player available at that position, that's what the Chiefs did here.
So I think the number of holes along the offensive line is why this is a little bit curious. Because I think signing an interior offensive line in free agency is typically a safe way to spend your money. We'll get to a couple of the other ones here in a second because I feel a little bit differently about those than I do about spending $16 million a year on Joe Tooney. They're going to have a very solid starter. He has been one of the most reliable offensive linemen in the NFL since he arrived into the league. He's never hurt. He plays every single snap. And one of the things I love with free agent offensive line additions, positional versatility. He can play center in a pinch. He's done that well. He can play tackle if you need him to. That's great. But a guard, no matter how good he is, only moves the needle so much. Is it smarter to say, all right, instead of $16 million for one guard, here's $8 million for one guard, $8 million for another guard. What can we do at tackle? It's possible they looked at the market and what they might be able to do in the draft and said, this is the best way to upgrade the positional unit. That's totally reasonable. But I still think we haven't seen huge guard deals move the needle that much. I like spending free agent money on the offensive line, not in more cautious ways, but just in more measured ways that spread it out a little bit more to fill holes rather than try to look for difference makers. And the amount of money they gave Joe Tooney on this deal, they expect him to be a difference maker at $16 million a year.
And, you know, it's always about weighing value and what does this team want? What do they need? And right now, when you talk about what do the Chiefs need, obviously they need tackles, and I think that's important. But it's those things that you just mentioned. It's consistency. It's a guy who's going to be reliable. It's a guy that has position versatility, because that's what they didn't have last year, and it really came back to bite them when they were trying to move guys around in the playoffs and heading into the Super Bowl and just didn't have kind of the right people there. I'm very curious where they're going to go from here. I mean, there was a report a couple days ago that they were looking forward to bringing Mike Remmers back, which, I mean, if you want to bring Mike Remmers back to be depth at one of your tackle positions, that's great. I'm not sure if I'm Patrick Mahomes and company, I'm feeling great about, you know, Mike Remmers as being one of your long-term answers at one of your tackle positions. This is a really good tackle draft. You know, they do, you know, they're not picking till 31. That's kind of a ways to go to maybe get one of the best tackles in this draft. But it is a position that they might be in a better position to address in the draft this year than you are in a typical year where tackle might not be quite as good. So, you know, I just thought it was an interesting move that the Chiefs kind of went in. They also did a bunch of restructures. Travis Kelce, Patrick Mahomes, Chris Jones all got restructures on their deals earlier to start the week so that they have a little bit of flexibility. So I'm curious to see where they go from here and kind of, what goes next? What are you going to do with those tackle positions?
I mean, it's possible that they looked at the available tackles in the market outside of Trent Williams and just said, we don't want to overspend on one of those guys. Because at tackle, that's typically what happens in free agency, right? We have teams that spend because there's such a scarcity at that position, and they typically get disappointed. Those guys don't live up to the deals that they receive. At guard, that doesn't typically happen. They're fine, and they play up to that level. But again, how much is a guard moving the needle, and where could those resources have gone? So I'll be really curious how they fill those other spots. You know, we looked at what the Bucs did last year and picking a tackle in the first round, having him start from day one and being an all-pro. That is not an advisable strategy when you're trying to figure out how to plug holes on your team in a given year. So if they're sitting there and thinking at 31, we're going to find our starting left tackle, that's a very dangerous game to play.
It's great if it works out, but, you know, I think the Bucs got a little bit lucky there. But Bruce Arians should be should remember just what value he got out of his rookies last year when he's talking about how, you know, lack of an offseason will hurt rookies because they won the Super Bowl in part because their rookies were so good. But yeah, so we'll see what happens. So the other offensive line big moves of the day were Corey Linsley going to the Chargers. He'll be their new starting center. I know you have studied a lot of Green Bay offensive line tape over the years. So what did you think of that one? That deal got done very shortly before we started recording.
Yeah, that. I don't even have the details in front of me because it happened so quickly, but he's going to be the highest paid center in the NFL by everything that's been reported. The AEV is not even in SpotTrack right now. So let me look at some of the deals. So 5 years, $62.5 million, which I think this is an interesting conceptual question. How much do you value center? And if you value center a lot and you think that it provides stability and can be kind of a force multiplier along your offensive line, it can make the guys around him better, it can ease the burden on your quarterback, then signing a center in free agency, I think, is a really smart move. It's worked out for a lot of different teams over the years. You look at some of the recent free agent center signings. Mitch Morse has been really good for Buffalo. I think he's been really good for Josh Allen. Ryan Jensen, again, going back to the Bucs, has been great in Tampa. He's been everything they wanted him to be after coming over from Baltimore. Alex Mack was really good in Atlanta. You know, that was one of the key pieces in turning that offense into the best offense in the NFL when he got there with Kyle Shanahan. So are the Chargers looking at Corey Linsley and thinking, yeah, it's a lot of money, but it's a safe bet. if we have him for the next 3 years playing at, even if it's not an all pro level like he did last year, but a step below that, if he's one of the best five or six centers in the league, is that worth it because of how much he's going to help Justin Herbert, how much stability he's going to bring to the offense, everything else? I tend to think spending on centers is worth it. And that's why I think it's a great move. I think it makes all the sense in the world. And it's actually a pairing that I kind of had circled as free agency was even getting started.
Yeah, Shiel Kapadia predicted that one. You know, he did his kind of dream scenarios for all of these free agents, and he wanted Lindsley to end up with the Chargers. What do you like about Lindsley as a player, and what makes him special as a center, do you think?
So smart. So smart. I remember a story when I wrote about him back in 2014. I did a story on the entire Packers offensive line, and he started early in his career. He got thrust into the starting lineup because I believe it was J.C. Treader got hurt, and he had to play and start in Seattle against that Seahawks team the year after they won the Super Bowl. And he told me a really funny story about that. But I remember Josh Sitton telling me that Corey just caught on to something. It's called a cross key. It's just something to kind of that younger players wouldn't necessarily notice as things were moving full speed. And he caught it like right early on when he was playing. And Josh Sitton is one of the smartest offensive linemen you'll ever meet. Everyone always says this. And he just saw Corey recognize that and was like, that's a really smart guy. And he's shown that. You know, I think that it took him a little while to get totally comfortable in their new system when Matt LaFleur came over. But when he settled in, you saw what he can do in year two of that system. Again, I just think an amazing stabilizing factor for a group and an offense that desperately needs it. They've been searching for answers along the offensive line and even at that position for years. They've had so many guys cycle in and out of those interior line positions in San Diego and LA. And I just think this is a great way to find a solution that gives you some reliability to spot where they haven't had it at all.
Especially now when everything is about making things easier for Justin Herbert. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you want to get tackles, obviously, but you know, if you got to get somebody else on the offensive line, it's going to be that center. So I just love that philosophically what the Chargers are doing there and where they're going to spend their money. And yes, he's going to be at the top of the market now, but you know, everything it's now all in with your rookie quarterback. He's on a rookie cornerback deal. So I really like that move. And then the other side of the value for the interior offensive line would be Kevin Zeitler, who was cut by the Giants, signed by the Ravens this morning. I believe it's $7.5 million. That's not as a massive deal. I mean,
it's
not
a great contract.
The top of the market.
It's a great deal. It's such a Ravens contract. Getting a guy who was cut for half of what Joe Tooney is going to make every single year, and he doesn't contribute to the comp pick formula. So they let Matt Judon walk. They're going to get a third back, and they sign Kevin Zeitler for half of what guys are going for on the market. He's a little bit older than Tooney is. Obviously, he doesn't have as kind of, you know, blemish free of a track record, but I still think that he is an immediate starter. He is an upgrade for them, and I think he's going to be really good. And as soon as I saw that, I was just like, yep, that makes total sense. I completely understand why they'd want to go that direction.
And the poor Bengals fans, right? I mean, so for days, weeks now, right, we've all been hyping up the Joe Tooney going back to Cincinnati, where he's from. Then, you know, Kevin Zeitler, there was a lot of maybe he could go back to the Bengals. And then this morning, now they're both off the board by the end of Monday, including Zeitler, who was very popular in Cincinnati before he left for kind of a big money deal in free agency a couple of years ago.
I forgot he even played on the Bengals.
Right? So, but there was became this hope of like he could come back. So it was like, oh, we're going to refortify this offensive line. We're finally going to protect Joe Burrow and all this stuff. And now both of those guys are gone. And Zeitler now is going to be in Baltimore and have to face the Bengals twice a year.
I think that's okay, though. I don't want Bengals fans to freak out. I want Bengals fans to take a step back, take a deep breath. The people who win free agency for interior offensive linemen on day one, it's not necessarily a sign of what's to come. You absolutely can find solutions at that position that are a little bit cheaper. You can spread out your money. Again, I mean, Mitch Morse was a big signing for the Bills, but if you look at some of the other things the Bills have done, and I think they're a really good example of how you can make free agency work for you. If you look at other things the Bills have done, especially on the offensive line in recent years, it's more modest deals. You're just plugging holes. I actually like that as an approach in free agency along the offensive line. If they end up getting a Matt Filer for, I don't know, $3 or $4 million less. Maybe not $3 or $4 million less than Zeitler, but like a little bit cheaper than Zeitler. If it's $6 million a year, that's okay. It may not be as big a name, but I just think that if you're finding solutions along the offensive line, you're doing okay. And you can find those solutions a week into free agency, 10 days into free agency. It doesn't have to be in the first 3 to 4 hours. So any Bengals fans that are creeping toward the bridge, like, it's all right. It's going to be fine. Like, just calm down. Take a breath. There's still going to be players available that can help you.
Well, that's, I think that's the message for basically every fan base outside of New England.
Yeah.
Here,
yeah,
we're sitting here at 5:30 Eastern on Monday. And here's most teams are not active. Like, the official market hasn't actually opened yet. And if you check Twitter around the NFL, its fan bases are going, what are they doing? What are you waiting for? Why are there been no deals yet? Except for New England, who I believe that Bill Belichick has been body snatched. I do not know what has happened to Bill Belichick over the last 24 hours, or because he's just been handing out deals left and right. I mean, they've basically signed guys for as much money this week than they have in like the last 5 years period. So what do you think?
I'm looking at it right now. So $53.2 million in guaranteed money over the past three off seasons, according to PFF. They've spent 52.8 today. And some of it is understand. So I go back and forth.
Sorry, I see this picture all of a sudden.
Where's the dog pick, Kent? If you're going to throw that up there, I want the dog. So there it is. Attaboy. That's what I like to see. So I understand some of it, and I don't understand some of it. I feel like the overall aggressiveness is a sign that they're not desperate, but they need solutions. You know, they, in a way, last year, got to see how the other half lived. They became a normal NFL team. And I think that's kind of created a little bit more desperation and urgency over there than you'd have in a typical offseason. They have money to spend and they're going out and getting guys. The Jonnu Smith contract is massive, but he instantly becomes their most explosive pass catcher. They needed something on that team. We've seen what they can do with tight ends in the past. It's been a spot they valued. 4 years, $50 million with $31 million guaranteed is a lot for Jonnu Smith. But if you increase his role, he's going to run some more routes. He's going to be a bigger piece of the offense. I can understand that. The one that's kind of curious to me is Matt Judon. And it's for this reason. I think scheme fit wise, he makes perfect sense. Now, if you look at the ways they use their edges, they want those guys to be versatile. They want them to be able to do a bunch of different stuff, whether it's blitzing, stunts, being able to cover in certain situations, being physical with tight ends. I think he perfectly fits their defense. But because they've pieced together their pass rush for so many years, they don't pay edge rushers. That because they're non-traditional in the way that they deploy them, they haven't paid those guys at the top of the market. And that's why going out and spending this much on one is a little bit surprising to me, even if he does fit what they want to do defensively.
And this is going to put him, I mean, it's not a top of the market pass rusher, kind of edge rusher contract, but it is going to put him in the top 10 for outside linebackers, which it's just such a, it's like you said, it's just such an un-Patriots-like way to go about paying guys. So I'm just really, really curious to see what's changed in New England. Why are they all of a sudden feeling like they can, you know, spend all this money? The other guys that they signed today, cornerback Jalen Mills was the other one. And then who am I missing? Who's the fourth guy that I'm forgetting off the top of my head here?
It's not on my list either. I don't know who the we'll find one in a second. Jalen Mills, I think that if you look at that, again, it makes sense, right? He's somebody who has positional versatility. He moved to play safety last year, playing closer to the line of scrimmage. We've seen all the things he's done in the past at those different spots. How well he's done that is a different question. I mean, you're really betting on New England's ability and that coaching staff's ability to extract the best out of him. They might be able to, and they love having all those different kinds of defensive backs that can do different things. But is there some redundancy with Kyle Duggar, who they picked? How does this fit in with Devin McCourty's future? All of that. Again, they're paying a lot of money for somebody who was not very good at times in Philadelphia. But like you asked, why are they doing this? Because they know they need answers. They know that they need answers immediately. They looked at what happened last year, and I've got to think that they came away thinking, we can't do that again. We cannot have a roster that is that talent deficient again. And this is how they're addressing it. It's shocking, But after last year, I can understand why they wanted to go this direction.
So when you look at the rest of the AFC East, you know, I think the Jets were the team that had a ton of
Devon Godshaw
spend.
Is the other guy they signed. They signed a nose tackle from Miami, which makes sense.
It positionally, I think it does. Didn't love the value on it, I think, just in terms of how much that
it's day one
was.
Of free agency, man. There's not going to be many value propositions here, which that's why it's surprising. The days of Bill Belichick laying on a dock while everyone else throws their money around, those days are very gone. We have moved very far away from that.
To be fair, he might be on a yacht. Right.
That's
now,
possible.
Somewhere,
yeah.
Or, you know, sitting on a dock in Nantucket while he's making these calls. Everybody learned they can do all their work from home now. So, but I think it's interesting where, you know, kind of going into this week, you looked at, okay, who in the AFC East can spend money? The Jets are at the very top of the list of, you know, who they want to go after. I think interior offensive lineman was a position that they were going to be very interested in. Didn't get any of those top three guys available that we just talked about, whether that was Tooney or Corey Linsley or even Kevin Zeitler. I believe they signed Gerard Davis from the Lions. You know, so you know they got kind of the top linebacker or one of the top linebackers who is available. But Miami has been really quiet so far, and you know, and Buffalo has been fairly quiet so far. Besides re-signing some of their own guys in recent days, Matt Milano last week, John Feliciano over the weekend. So, what do you think when you look at the AFC East now? Just kind of that landscape of that division.
Well, with Buffalo. With Buffalo, I mean, a lot of that news happened over the weekend, right? Where they signed Matt Milano to that deal, which we hit on last week's show. But then you have guys like Feliciano coming back. And it's interesting because the Bills were aggressive in free agency over the last few years, but it's mostly because they filled so many different positions in free agency. They weren't spending at the top of the market. They were doing a lot of, all right, let's sign two interior pass rushers. Let's sign a couple different edge guys. Let's sign a couple different receivers in that $8 to $10 million range and try to piece it together. But now they've found those guys. It's a lot easier to sign players to big time extensions or to hand out a little bit more money when you've seen them in the building. We'll get one of those deals here in a second. But I just think it's a lot safer and GMs are a lot more comfortable when you know the people that you're handing that sort of money to. It's a lot easier to sign John Feliciano to a multi-year extension when you've seen what he does in your offense. Same goes for Darrell Williams, who they re-signed. And that's what I think we're seeing. I think we're seeing the Bills understand the formula that they followed last year worked. Let's do everything we can to retain that. And that's why I think the Shaq Barrett thing is so fascinating. So the Bucks, I love the fact that Bruce Arians, however many Coors Lights deep he was during that parade, screaming, "You guys aren't going anywhere. You're all coming back." And he actually meant it. Like every single person at that Bucks boat parade was that dude at 2 a.m. who's like, "We should hang out more." And they actually meant it. They like, this is the first time that everyone was very drunk and throwing around all these lovey-dovey statements and actually followed through on them. And I just think it's fat. I mean, the deal itself is 4 years, $72 million, which is tolerable. And if you're looking at the edge rushing market, it's a little bit less than guys at the top of that market have made. And this is just a reminder that if you want to keep everyone, you can. It just requires some sacrifices later on. Brady doing that extension and adding all those voidable years to those deals, that puts them in a position to be aggressive in ways they hadn't before. One of the reasons that they've been able to do this is because they had no dead money left on their cap. They didn't push money into future years ever. And if you don't have any dead money, that's when the cap is fake. Because then you can do all of these extensions and play with the numbers and everything else. And they were able to do it pretty comfortably. I mean, this isn't something where they had to do all these crazy restructures. It was only one or two. So they really did put the band back together. Were you surprised that they were able to do this, or did you think that this was always in the cards for them?
I mean, I know that they wanted to. I mean, yes, they were, you know, kind of like drunk and really, really happy at the boat parade. But they were saying that within an hour of the Super Bowl ending, that Sunday night in Tampa, Bruce Arians was very clear that this was something that he wanted to happen. But, you know, you get a month into it, the agents start talking to each other, you know, the one common thread through a lot of these deals that we've seen today is that most of these guys are represented by Drew Rosenhaus, who's not necessarily a guy who is known for, you know, having his clients take below market deals or team friendly deals. Shaq Barrett could have gotten more if he wanted to. If Shaq Barrett had wanted to reset that market, had wanted to be, you know, have the deal that everybody was doing, the eye-popping emojis and the holy crap, I can't believe how much he got, he could have done that today. Somebody would have paid him at the very top of that market. You know, they probably got some calls, you know, really checked out to see exactly what other sort of offers were out there Monday morning, and then decided, do you want to break the bank? Or do you want to get a very good deal and go back to a place where you know you're comfortable, the scheme fits you, your family is happy, and you could potentially win another Super Bowl next year? And Shaq Barrett was a guy who decided to, I'm going to stay here. And, you know, look, the Bucks have been very good to him so far. I mean, they brought him in when there wasn't a huge market for him 2 years ago. You know, they kept him on the franchise tag last year with kind of the understanding of, we will make this work for you. And come here, we're going to win, we're building something special, and then it's going to pay off. And ultimately now it's paid off for Shaq Barrett. And, you know, good for him. I mean, he, you know, he probably could have gotten a little more, but this is by far the best situation for him, and it's the best situation for the Bucks as well.
It the same thinking applies here that applied to what we're talking about with the Bills. You bring him in on that one year short-term deal, he gets the tag. Now, when you're giving him this massive contract, some of the downsides and pitfalls we normally see with free agency disappear. You know what kind of guy he is. You know how he fits into your defense. You can have an understanding of what that contract is going to do to his production and everything else. So it's worth taking that chance because you're no longer concerned. You're no longer concerned with, all right, what is this going to do if we give this guy all of this money? There's a certainty there, and that allows them to sign this deal without any hesitation, where they couldn't have done that 2 years ago. So, and you get a slight discount because of the culture that you've built. He wants to be there because of what it feels like there. And in order to understand that and come at that lower price, you have to have him in the building. You have to make the initial signing 2 years ago the way that they did it. This is why this is fun. Ian Rapoport reporting, the Raiders are close to a deal with Yannick Ngakoue. Makes total sense. This is becoming an annual thing with the Raiders. They get very excited about the shiny guys in free agency. They pay them top of the market money. And then 2 years later, they do the whole thing again. Kidding aside, I completely understand why they want to do this. He's a guy that has had fantastic production over the course of his career. I think that there's probably a reason he changed teams twice over the course of the last year. There are some concerns about what he's like in non-defined passing situations, how good of a run defender is he, everything else. But this is a team that desperately has needed to upgrade its pass rush. He is a very good pure pass rusher. What do you think about Ngakoue to the Raiders, even if we don't know the price yet?
God, he's a perfect Raider. Like, he was born to be a Raider. Like, at this point, I'm stunned it hasn't happened yet. This is going to be his fourth team, and I'm just stunned. Like, he was born to go play for the Raiders. Just, I think personality-wise, he fits. He obviously fits the mold of a Raiders free agent signing. I hope that doesn't mean that he's going to end up being kind of a bust, because that's what's happened, unfortunately, in a lot of the Raiders' splashy moves over the last couple of years. But you're 100% right that he fills a massive need. And if he can become a really good player every down, where he's not kind of just a third down threat, you know, I think this could be a really, really good signing. I do want to see what the value is over there. The Raiders do have a history of overpaying guys. I think that might be the polite way to say this. So, you know, we're waiting to see exactly what these terms are going to be here. But, you know, they play in a division where there's a lot of really good pass rushers, and they have not had any. And I think they're all just tired of answering those questions about who's going to rush the passer, how are you going to get after the quarterback. They've tried to address it a lot of different ways over the last few years. None of them have worked since getting rid of Khalil Mack in that trade a couple of years ago. So maybe this can partially be that answer. But I think it fits. He's going to look really cool in silver and black. You know, he's got like the most ridiculous crop cross-chop move in the NFL. So I'm excited to see that. But I just want to see kind of where he goes in this next phase of his career. I mean, last year was just so tumultuous, going from Jacksonville to Minnesota, then to Baltimore, changing schemes, changing defenses, the whole thing. So now, you know, now at least he'll get to be settled. He's got a long-term contract for, we'll see exactly how much money soon. And now the Ravens, I mean, I don't think it's surprising that Ngakoue and Judon were both going to end up leaving, but the Ravens now have to completely remake that position as well. So this affects a couple of AFC teams.
Yeah. I mean, the Ravens are in their normal thing where they let a pass rusher walk in free agency, get the comp pick a year later, pick a pass rusher with the comp pick, let the pass rusher walk in 4 years, get the comp pick back. It's a cycle that keeps continuing. The Raiders, if you look at the way they've spent, obviously, they've been really aggressive in free agency over the last few years. The hope has to be that now with Gus Bradley in there, that scheme-wise, you can start getting the most of some of these players. I think that some of the bets they've made were probably misguided from the start, you know, whether it's Cleveland Farrell with the fourth overall pick, stuff like that. They haven't been consumed with value in the way that they've spent some of these resources, but I do think it's not an accident that those guys consistently have underperformed when Paul Gunther was there. Now, hopefully, with Bradley coming in, you know, we've seen what he can get from Joey Bosa, Melvin Ingram. Maybe there's an uptick in the production from some of these additions now that they have a little bit of a better chance schematically to get started here.
Also, right. I mean, now that you mentioned Gus Bradley, Gus Bradley was the coach in Jacksonville when Yannick Ngakoue was drafted.
That's right.
It's a known quantity. Ngakoue had some of his best seasons playing for Bradley. So didn't put those two together until you mentioned Bradley and then it clicked. So there you go. When it's a guy who maybe has had some, you know, he's a fiery guy, right? He's gotten into disagreements with teammates and stuff, but Bradley knows probably how to handle him and maybe how to get the best version of Yannick Ngakoue. So there, it makes even more sense now that you put the defensive coordinator and player together.
I think that, you know, it can be funny sometimes when you have these guys with previous connections that drives free agency. I mean, you think the Bills, they've signed so many former Panthers, but that matters. If you know the guy's personality, if you know what he's like and what he is in certain situations and how you can use him and everything else, it eliminates a layer of risk from this. And when you're spending what I assume is going to be, I don't know, $18 million on a guy, you want to eliminate as much risk as possible. And I think that Bradley's familiarity with him is a way to do that. So let's get to another defensive signing in the AFC that I absolutely love. And that's John Johnson to the Browns. 3 years, $33.75 million, $24 million guaranteed. The Browns' plan this offseason was very simple. They had a lot of money and they were going to spend it on defense. If you look at that defensive depth chart, Myles Garrett, Denzel Ward, and I guess Grant Delpit, he didn't really play last year, but that was it when it came to building blocks that they had on defense. Other than that, they could kind of paint this defense the way they wanted to and use their resources to do exactly that. And I think Johnson makes perfect sense. You know, they're going to be able to line up him and Delpit and Ronnie Harrison together. I think that's going to allow them to marginalize the linebacker position even more. I don't expect them to sign one. So I really like this. I think this is a perfect signing in terms of need and a perfect signing for where modern football is headed. What was your reaction when you saw this one?
Love it. It was one of my favorite moves of the day. I'm working on a piece that's going to be published later Monday evening on The Athletic about kind of superlatives about the day, good value, favorite moves, teams that maybe overspend. And I was having a hard time figuring out exactly which category to put this signing in because I think it's a really good value. I also think it's a really good fit. So, you know, he's making a lot of money, but he's not resetting the safety market. And, you know, I think it's just a good value for the Browns, and they had to get better on the back end of their defense. It was one of the biggest questions every single game that we talked about the Browns late last season as they were making that push where they were even in the running to win the AFC North. They had to figure out, they just didn't have great answers in their secondary. And John Johnson is going to give them so much flexibility. He's able to play all over that defensive backfield. He's going to be a really good leader. He's got, he's just kind of like a tone setting, fiery kind of guy. Really, really liked him. If you watched Hard Knocks at all last summer, you really liked John Johnson. he's learned from a lot of really good guys. You know, he played alongside Eric Weddle for a couple of years, and he picked up a lot, I think, from him. So I think it's a really good culture fit. I think it's a great scheme fit. And I'm just really excited about that move. If you're the Browns and you're a Browns fan, they haven't signed a pass rusher yet. It might be coming. There's still a few really good pass rushers available on the market. But this was a great one. You went and got the best safety that was out there, and you didn't have to spend a fortune to do it.
I love it. I just think that if you look at what he did for the Browns last year, really ton of awareness, just a really smart player, very good in zone coverage. And you look at that very complicated zone defense the Rams played last year. He was just so comfortable. Also, their signal caller, their defensive play caller at that spot. I just think having that sort of leadership, intelligence, everything else as they try to remake this defense is interesting to me. And I know that they're going to try to find some pass rushers. You know, I don't know if they'll be at the top of the market for a guy like Trey Hendrickson or a guy like Carl Lawson, or if they'll try to piece this together. I wouldn't be surprised if they were a team that was trying to get Jadeveon Clowney at a discount. If somebody that really they could just drop in to be a chaos creator along that defensive line with Myles Garrett, that kind of thing, where they want to try to find values and piece together the pass rush more than saying we need a $15 million a year guy to pair with Garrett. So I'll be curious how they go about that. But again, all they want to do is add defensive talent and defensive explosiveness. And that's where they're starting with John Johnson, which is great. So one more big signing here before we get out of here. Romeo Okwara back to the Lions. 3 years, $39 million. Makes sense to me. I loved him. I thought he could help out a lot of teams. But if you're a Lions team that's trying to retain young talent, trying to build this team from scratch, essentially, especially on defense, he's a really good young piece. So it's not surprising to me that he would want to stay.
Yeah, I mean, I think our Lions guys were a little surprised that he ended up coming back. I think maybe they just thought he would have a really good market and just might want to go somewhere else, you know, when you look at kind of where the Lions have been. But
well, his brother's there too, right? Which is, yep. I think, is something to consider.
Yes, his brother is there, and now they're going to kind of be the building block pieces, potentially. I believe that's what Chris Burke, our Lions beat writer, was writing earlier today. But yeah, it was a little bit surprising that it got done for him to stay and for that deal to get done early today. But you look, I think there were a lot of defensive guys who played for the Lions and were maybe misused over the last couple of years who maybe didn't reach their full potential and, you know, have good talent, and now they can, you know, maybe get into a different scheme, a different coaching staff, and might have a little bit more success. So, you know, that was a position that the Lions decided to spend at. They didn't have to, you know, break the bank. I mean, this is not, you know, the 3 years, $39 million. That's not a massive deal. I think that's kind of in the range of a lot of the deals that we're going to be seeing this year. You know, not market shattering type of contracts that are getting handed out by any means. But, you know, it's good to have a little bit of consistency there because they are losing a lot of their other impending free agents.
Couple quick ones here before we get out of here. Jason Verrett back to San Francisco on a 1 year deal. Love it. He was great for them last year. 1 year is $5.5 million. If he plays at the level he did a year ago, that's a huge bargain for a team that I think is trying to figure out what they want their secondary to be with guys like Kaywan Williams and Jaquiski Tartt, others hitting free agency. And Darius Williams, first round tender from the Rams, $4.8 million. He was fantastic last year. So two NFC West corners that know the systems they're about to play in, the coaching staff, everyone is familiar with them there. I think that makes sense to me. And then Roy Robertson-Harris, who I think a lot of other people don't really know about. If you're like not like a football person, I think he's probably somebody you haven't watched a lot. He was excellent in Chicago. Long interior presence. He goes to Jacksonville. And then I think somebody who plays a similar role or played a similar role in that Bears defense in Denver for Vic Fangio is Shelby Harris, who, again, you know Shelby Harris, but I think other people are probably surprised at the money that Shelby Harris got. Where do you think where does he fit into the Broncos' defensive plans in your mind?
Yeah, well, I mean, they already let go of Jarrell Casey. They let go of AJ Bouye. So a lot of the guys that they spent money on in recent years that didn't work out. And now he's going to kind of be the focal point of that defensive line, at least at this point. So Shelby Harris was a guy that they got real cheap a couple years ago. He left to test the free agent market last year, didn't find a massive market, came back to Denver on a one-year deal and was their best defensive lineman, you know, outside of Bradley Chubb, you know, but he was their best like interior defensive lineman, play in and play out. just a really good dude too, just like really lovable. Everybody, you know, everybody loves him in that locker room. And I'm glad to see he got paid, and he had to be a priority. I mean, he's just like a great, like Vic Fangio guy. And the thing that Shelby Harris is known for is he has these just massive hands, and he bats down like a ridiculous amount of passes. Like, I don't know where it's come from. He's blocked multiple field goals, but I really was happy to see him sign in Denver. And I just think when you talk about a guy like him and the two cornerbacks that you mentioned with Darius Williams and Jason Verrett, you know, and then even to Shaq Barrett, the biggest moves, and I think the best moves that often happen in this phase of free agency, are the guys who re-sign with their previous teams. We get really excited to talk about these guys changing teams, the potential like big money that's getting thrown around for guys to move and switch teams. But ultimately, the decisions or the moves that are going to impact teams the most, a lot of times the guys that they keep, the guys that they don't let get away. So I think all three of those are really good examples of, you know, smart signings, value signings, guys that, you know, they just value them, and they didn't let them leave the building once the market opened.
And the same goes for Michael Davis, the cornerback from the Chargers who just re-signed there. I mean, they are in full evaluation mode about how they want to shape that defense. They seem to think that he was a fit for what they wanted to do. He's back playing for Brandon Staley, which I'm very excited to watch. He's a long, talented guy. I think that makes total sense. Lindsey Jones, thank you very much. We'll talk to you soon.
We made it through the show without my preschooler bursting in. It's a miracle.
We're crushing it. It's been a great day. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
I'm very happy to welcome now somebody that I can't believe I haven't had on the podcast yet, almost a half a year in. Former NFL player, host of Jeff Schwartz is Smarter Than You, another great football podcast. My good buddy, Jeff Schwartz. How you doing, man?
I am glad to be here, and I am glad that our sport never stops. I don't think we've ever had an offseason like this. Free agency hasn't even been here. We had no combine either. And every single day, there is someone getting traded, being rumored to be traded, being cut, being released. The salary cap is down a bunch this year. The franchise tag, like it is, it's a great time to cover the NFL.
It really is. It's nonstop. So full disclosure, we're recording this on Friday afternoon. It's not going to run until Tuesday. So we're going to try to keep any sort of newsy mentions to a minimum in order to not make this seem outdated. And it's going to be okay. And it's going to be easy to do because I wanted to have a conversation with you that was more of a look back. So of all the different ways we've talked about free agency on the show here over the last couple of weeks, one side we haven't hit is the perspective of a player who's been through it before. And you have on multiple different levels. Yes. I remember the first time you and I ever interacted, this was right before you were hitting free agency in 2014 with the Giants. And I wrote a piece about some of the prospective free agents for Grantland. And you reached out and said you thanked me publicly for actually watching you play before I wrote about you as a free agent prospect. Because no one else was going to watch you as a guard in the limited time you played in Kansas City before they said, oh yeah, Jeff Schwartz should make this amount of money in free agency this year in this class. So you appreciated that, and I appreciated you noticing it.
First of all, we read everything. If anyone tells you they don't read like what's written about them, or like a coach is like, I didn't see that. No, they all saw it. Look, with offensive linemen, it's very tough, obviously, to watch everything we do. And Pro Football Focus does provide, you know, a little bit of help with that. I don't always agree with their grades, but I think that they go about it in the right way. And, you know, they generally are pretty accurate. I was very highly rated with them as well. But it goes further when someone watches your film and you know, likes what you're doing. And it's just, to me, it's so different how free agency is. I mean, really, the money has changed in just 7 years. I mean, if you had, you know, let's just assume this year was a normal year for the cap. I mean, I would have made, I don't know, if I was the same player I was in 2013 hitting in 2014 as I was now in free agency, I'd make 2.5-3 times as much. It's just the money is so much different now.
I mean, at that point, though, $4 million a year for a starting level guard was pretty decent money. You got like, you were a coveted player. Yes. In that free agent class, you got money guaranteed, everything else. So I want to talk about that experience first.
Okay.
Because, you know, I've talked with some guys in the past. I remember I mentioned this a couple shows ago, but when I wrote about the Packers a couple years ago, I had a pretty frank conversation with their free agent class about how they had arrived there, the Smiths, Adrian Amos. And it really was one of the first times that I had gotten to look behind the curtain from the player's perspective. So when you were entering free agency that year, how did the process go? Like, what was the first benchmark in your mind of, okay, this is the experience of being an in-demand free agent? Like, was it around the combine?
Well, so, you know, my path to getting kind of that so-called second contract was just different than a lot of these guys, right? I mean, I was in year, I was heading to year seven. I had been hurt a bunch of my career. I'd taken some one-year deals. And, you know, with the Kansas City, I'm very grateful for the Chiefs. I mean, I started a couple of games early in the year for injury, and then John Osamoa, the right guard, got hurt, and I played really well at Denver and then against the Chargers in back-to-back weeks. And they're like, look, you're playing well. We're just going to keep you in the lineup. And I was like, that's not normal, by the way. Normally they just go back to the starter. And so, you know, I played really well. And, you know, the combine's the first time when you start talking with teams, you know, of course, very quietly because it's not allowed. And my agent just said, like, hey, these teams are kind of interested. But the first time I realized I wasn't going to be back in Kansas City was when the Chiefs offered me like a nothing deal. And then I realized like very quickly, like, okay, I'm out of here. I'm preparing to go somewhere else. And then my agent told me he had a number to get. He said he wanted to get $4 million a year. No one believed he can get that for me. Again, considering my age, my injury history, and just kind of, I hadn't had an entire season worth of film since 2010, right? I mean, I played well in 2013, but I started, I think, only 7 or 8 games. And the tampering period, that was the first or second year of the legal tampering period. And it just happened to fall on the day of my wedding. So, I got
married. I'm sure your wife was thrilled.
So, okay. So my wife doesn't pay attention to any of this. So she really had no idea. So the morning of the wedding, my wife and her party are at the hotel. I'm at my parents' house and we're on the West Coast. So 9 a.m. is when the tampering period opens up. And so
it's always so funny to me that you guys are from LA. I always forget that you're LA kids. You don't seem like it at all, but continue.
We are very much LA kids. So my agent, who's obviously at the wedding, he gets a bunch of calls at 9 a.m. We were having like an out of town brunch at my parents' house the morning of the wedding. And so like at 9:20-ish, 9:25, Derek is like, look, we've gotten like as many calls as we're probably going to get. Let's go talk about it. So we went in the living room. It was me, my dad, my brother, and my uncle. I believe my uncle was there. And we just listed out. There were 9 teams that called them. And we kind of made like a pros and cons list. I remember distinctly saying like any team in California had to offer me a lot more because of taxes. Like that's a real thing. And I was like, look, I think the Raiders were in charge. I was like, look, I don't want to go there, but if they want to offer me X amount more than anyone else, sure, I'll go there. But we kind of have the Giants as the lead from the beginning. I think my agent thought after the combine, they were very interested in me. And when you looked at the teams and where I was positioned and where they were positioned, the Giants just felt like a good fit, right? For years, their offensive line had been outstanding. When you look at that Super Bowl winning offensive line, and of course with Coughlin, Eli, and just living in New York City was a place that we wanted to go. And they came with the best offer. And really, I mean, I think people believe these offers like that you haggle for. And I think for quarterbacks, you do. For like Dak Prescott, it's a haggle back and forth, right? Pat Mahomes, I think for a lot of these other deals, it's not. I think people think they go back. I think it was like, okay, here's what we're looking for. The Giants offered, we countered. Okay, we're good. And like by that night after my wedding, I knew what the target number was, $4 million a year. After the wedding, my agent came up to me. We're the cocktail
reception.
Cocktail hour. And he goes, we're good. We got what we wanted from the Giants. We're good. And I was like, all right, cool. Told my wife, and she's like,
How deep were you at that point? Were you doing okay?
So I don't drink. So I was pretty sober. I think actually the last time I might have like really gotten a little buzz was probably at the wedding. I drank a little bit later in the night. We just like finished pictures again. It was crazy. And I told my wife, and Meredith had like no idea. She's like, whatever. I don't really know what you're talking about. And then the next couple of days, nothing really budged. The free agency opened, so I flew home, and then Saturday or Sunday? I think free agency was Monday or Tuesday, the first start of the league year. And my agent called me and goes, look, the Rams want you. They're offering about the same as the Giants, but we're going to New York. And I was like, okay, fine. He goes, when they call you at 4 o'clock, don't take the call. So I think I turned down talking to Jeff Fisher. Like they called at 4 o'clock. I just went right to voicemail. Giants called me at 4:01 or something, scheduled my flight. I knew that I was going to get money. I knew whatever I got was going to be more than I ever made in my career. But I did not know I was going to get the money that I thought I'd get till the day of my wedding. Like until nine teams called, right? Like until it was a big deal that everyone called. I did not know I'd get as much as we thought I'd get. People told my agent, we're never getting $4 million a year. So I was pretty pumped that we got tied a bit over that. So I was pumped about that.
I think that the number of teams in the running really helps shape the market for guys. And that makes sense, right? It's the demand and it dictates how much you're going to make. But I've talked to agents a lot about this, and the idea of going from two to three teams can be a huge multiplier in the amount of money that you could potentially make because you could pit them against one another. So until you know exactly how many teams are going to be in, it's hard to gauge exactly what your market is going to be. And I think this year especially has been really murky on the agent side. There are just so fewer answers because there have been fewer conversations in the way that we typically have them at the combine, everything else. So I think there's kind of a shroud of mystery over what it's going to look like more than there is in a typical year.
I think that's definitely true. And also in most seasons, if you know, there's like 12 wide receivers, right, that are high quality, I'd say, you know, middle to high quality guys. I think in most years, all of them just get paid a lot of money. This year, you know, I think agents are trying to figure out, like, is my guy like that top guy that everyone's after? Am I the next tier? Because there's not enough money to go around this year. There really is not, because of the cap situation where everyone's at and the lowering of the salary cap. So I think agents are also trying to figure out, like, where's my guy fit? Is he a guy that everyone wants to pay right away? Is he like, yeah, he's 1C for their team? Is he 2? And I think no one really knows. And plus, there's more cuts coming. Like, teams have to get under the cap. And so there's going to be more free agents flooding the market before the start of free agency than ever before.
And you look at it, I think the receiver group is a good spot to look at. Let's say how many teams are in the market for a true number one guy with the money to spend on it. The Jets, Washington. Colts. I don't think the Colts will spend on a true number one guy.
Right, but they have the money to do it if they want
to. So, but I almost am writing them off because I just don't think that's something that fits
Miami?
There. So Miami, I think, would be the third, maybe. Yeah. So let's say there are three guys. So let's say that three of them are in the market for a Kenny Golladay type. If you removed Kenny Golladay from that equation, then Corey Davis comes up into that three teams looking for a number one receiver thing. So just the little tiny changes are so important. So when you were making those pros and cons lists, as you were looking at those teams, what were the factors that you had listed and how did you kind of stack them up? If we're removing money from the equation.
Well, that's like 90% of it, right?
I know that. I know that it's the biggest part. And it's so funny because you said, my agent told me we're going to New York. I think that is more common than people think from the outside. Where agents are like, no, that was the best offer. That's what we're doing.
Well, I think that here's the thing. And J.J. Watt's a good example of this because he signed with the Cardinals. Is a lot of players say, I'm going to take less because I want to go do this and that.
Yep.
And guys, it's hard to turn down millions of dollars. Like JJ Watt, I mean, there was that one report from Arizona that someone offered him more. That's just not true, okay? No one offered him more than $23 million guaranteed.
He took the best offer. I can tell you that right now.
I know he did. And so it's hard to turn down, like, let's say the next best offer, I would imagine, maybe you know best, I'm just guessing, was instead of $23 million guaranteed, it was 12. I don't know, 10 or 12 sounds probably about what it would have been, maybe. One-year deal around there somewhere. That's a lot of $10 million. It's a lot of money, even for guys who have money. And so, yes, you go to where the money is. Very rarely are guys taking significantly less to go somewhere. It's just like, look, the Giants deal was structured better. We're going there. So back to your question about what mattered to me. I think location mattered. You know, like, I think the chance to win mattered a lot, too. And the Giants obviously had shown the ability with Tom Coughlin to win. Even when I was there, we weren't very successful. But I always thought in the back of my head, like, especially in 2015, we were 6-6 or 5-5 at the time. It's like, look, we just go on a run. Like, they've done it before. We just go on a run. We can do it. So I wanted to win. I think the success of their offensive line in the past had been something that was very important to me.
Did you know anyone there? Did you talk to anyone who had played for him or played in that building?
No, I hadn't. And what's really interesting looking back on it is I think offensive linemen now, maybe, are more conscious of play style. So I look back on it, and I did not fit the Giants' offense at all. Like what Ben McAdoo wanted to do, 0%. They were in shotgun and two-point stances. I am not a shotgun, two-point stance guy. I'm going to give me a three-point stance in shotgun, fine. Everyone's in shotgun now. I shouldn't fit their offense. And if I had maybe known like they were going to be in this offense, maybe I'd choose to go somewhere else. The thing about St. Louis, I was thinking to myself, like, I'm in the NFC West. There was the Justin Smith and Ray McDonald. There was Aaron Donald just been drafted, I think. There was a couple guys in Arizona, the Seattle defense. I was like, look.
Calais Campbell was still there in Arizona.
Dockett might have been there.
That was his tail end of his career there. Yep.
And then Seattle, they were in like Super Bowls. And I was like, I don't want to go there. Like, I want a chance to win. I want a good chance to like go to New York. So that all played a role in it. But yeah, the scheme thing is really interesting because the more I'm out of the NFL, the more I look at these kind of things like scheme to me, scheme fit. They don't match up with offensive linemen as much as they should. It's a problem. And if I had known, maybe I'd choose somewhere else.
When Mitch was picking between teams, I know that you told him about what Kansas City was like and what playing for Andy Heck was like and everything else. What else about his process sticks out to you?
Well, just the Browns and like the way they handled it and just kind of the way that it was that for me, the way that things were leaked out about what happened. Like everyone thinks the Browns made him the best offer. They did not make him the best offer. Guaranteed money is important in offers. And it doesn't like you could offer someone a 5-year deal for $100 million, but you guarantee only one of the seasons. Is that better than a 5-year deal for $50 million, but you guarantee two seasons? Like it's the guaranteed money is what matters in the NFL. Otherwise, you just cut you after one season. Like that's what matters. It wasn't that extreme. I think that was it to me, like just the way the Browns handled it from their end. I was very happy he went to Kansas City. The one thing about that year is the right tackle market just didn't go up. And I don't know why. You know, everyone was saying like Mitch is going to get $8-9 million a year. It wasn't like we just made that number out of our minds. And then Kansas City, obviously I think it was 6.5, somewhere around there. And it's a great deal for him. It was his big second contract too. That's what I remember most about it. It just was a very weird year. Like it again, everyone, I mean, you probably wrote the same thing. Like Mitch is getting $8-9 million a year. That's what everyone thought and just did not
I
happen.
Remember that now. I forgot. I hadn't thought about that for a little while, but that the stagnation of that market was really interesting. And it took Lane Johnson to kind of jar it out of that.
Yeah.
And the only reason that even happened is because the understanding was that they were paying him anticipating that he'd eventually move to left tackle.
Yeah.
And it never made any sense to me. And I think that if you look at the movements of the market at a lot of other positions, you get it, right? Like, I think that it makes sense that running backs have been devalued when you think about the replaceability of the position, even though it sucks for them. If you look at the amount of safeties hitting the market, and where you can find acceptable safety play, third round, fourth round, especially as teams go motor too high, you can understand why there are more safeties at a cheaper price available in free agency. But at right tackle, it doesn't make sense. It's at this point, it's almost as valuable as having a left tackle. And the scarcity and the depressed market there never really tracked to me in the same way it might in other positions.
Well, I think we're getting out of that. I mean, with the Trent Brown signing, obviously now he's with New England, but like paying Trent Brown all that money to play at right tackle.
Yep. Juwan James got a really nice contract to play right tackle. Yeah.
And I think in the draft with what Tristan Wirfs did, right? You sign him, you put him on the team, and he made Tampa Bay that much better. You know, this draft is more left tackle dominated. I think, you know, there's some right tackles at maybe the end of the first round, but I do think teams are valuing it a little bit more. Now the money obviously is not quite as the same, but when Mitch was signed, it wasn't valued quite the same. And what's interesting is he was signed in a division that had Von Miller and Bosa eventually got drafted there.
And Khalil Mack.
And Khalil Mack. Like these guys were there. Now again, Bosa was drafted, I think the year Mitch was there. So he wasn't drafted quite yet, but you're paying him all his money to block the best guys and you're not paying him like your left tackle.
I remember he and I had a conversation that year or the year after, and I was reading off the schedule to him and just what it was like every single week. And he didn't have like a week off for like 9 weeks of the season. For whatever reason, that year just broke wrong.
But that's just like the NFL, man. Like when do you get a week? I mean, this year or last year was really easy. It was relatively easy for him. It wouldn't have been this year. Maybe it was 2019 or 2018 where like, you know, well, Von Miller got hurt or something like that. And Bosa was hurt the game they played. But like, that's the thing about the NFL. People ask me the difference between college and NFL. And my answer is always in the NFL, you're playing NFL players every week. Like they're all good. In college, you know, play Washington State or Oregon State, you're not facing a pro defensive end. It's like every week. That's the thing about it's just this league is it's hard and right tackle. Again, I don't think it's being valued as much, even though it should.
So when you got to New York and you lived in New Jersey, but when you arrive in a building as that free agent, how do you start making connections? Like, is your first day there? I'm sure you talk to your offensive line coach or the head coach or whoever, but how quickly do you reach out to other guys in the room? How much do you know them before you get there? What's the process of acclimating to a new team when you sign a deal like that?
So I sought out Chris Snee first. Chris was still there. He was the veteran of the group, obviously a fantastic player from the Giants. I think he's in the Ring of Honor there now as well, two-time Super Bowl champion. But he was injured, but he was still there and he was still part of the team. And so he was the first guy I called and tried to get a relationship with. And
how do you get that number? Do you have mutual friends?
I think I just asked the offensive line coach.
Okay.
Something like that. But you know,
I'm always curious
about
that.
But when I you know, when Eric Fisher got drafted, I was in Kansas City, or when we drafted, I think Eric Flowers in New York, I text the O-line coach, like, hey, can I get his number and send him a text? Like, I think it's pretty simple. So just like Chris, he was the oldest guy on the team and, you know, the veteran who everyone looked up to. So I sought him out. And when the first day I got there, I went and talked to Eli, I would imagine. I'm not sure. I don't know if Eli texted me or not when I got signed there. And you just go to work when you get there, right? You just try to make friendships. Every place I went to, I tried to, you know, my wife came up. We went to dinner with, I don't know if we went to dinner with Chris or not. Maybe we did. You remember like Weston, when Weston was drafted? I knew Weston anyways, so that was easy enough. But I think you just go find the veteran and start talking to the veterans and you get in the building. The equipment managers know everything. Those are guys to be friends with as well. So you get there, you make friends with those guys and you just like anyone in a new job. You go in there and you give effort and you have fun and you enjoy yourself and you make friends. The Giants is unique there. I enjoy my time there, but not like a lot of places.
In what way?
You know, at least in the offensive line, like it's very, you know, very much. And for this is again, for various, their offensive line was fantastic. I remember we watched them when I was in Carolina in 08, like as a rookie, we watched them play all the time. They were a great offensive line. But those guys were gone and they just still kind of like didn't realize they had new offensive linemen that weren't those guys. And that was, it was like tough to be in their shadow. You know what I mean? Like they were all gone and yet it just felt like they were still there. That makes sense.
Just like the way they went about teaching it and the expectations and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, expectations are, you should always have high expectations. That's not like a thing. Of course you should be high expectations, but like I was not Chris Snee. Like I was never trying to be Chris Snee. And I'm like, coach, man, like I'm not Chris. Like I'm not, I don't do what he does. I don't do it as well. I'm not 6'3", like I'm 6'7". Like that's like, you got to kind of, that's, you know what I mean? Like I'm not that player. Yeah. It was an interesting dynamic there. Again, I loved being there. I loved the team. The ownership was great. The training staff, like everyone was great. Everyone was awesome. But it just was a unique vibe in that offensive line room.
When you get paid and you arrive as that guy rather than somebody fighting for a roster spot, is it just a different feeling going to work every day? How does the dynamic shift when you kind of step into that range of player?
Obviously you're now kind of looked at as more like of a leader, obviously, but I think you have to kind of earn it. Like you can't just go in there and expect everyone to think, you know, that you deserve that money. And my problem was I got hurt right away. Like I got to New York, I was playing out of position. I was playing left guard and I got hurt in the preseason and I wasn't playing as well left guard as I had played my entire career at right guard and right tackle. And so camp wasn't going as well as probably I wanted it to go. Preseason games were fine. I was playing okay. And I just got hurt. And so like they paid me all this money and then I got hurt. And I think the common misconception about guys getting paid is that we then like, we shut it down. Like we don't want, no, it's the opposite. Like I wanted to prove I was worth the money. I wanted to prove to my teammates, to ownership, to everyone else that they paid the right guy. They paid me this money and I could deliver on what they were paying me to do. And I regret I wasn't able to do that because I was always hurt. And like the first year I'm there, you know, I get hurt in the preseason. It wasn't like I was hurt in the regular season. I got hurt in the preseason. And then I got hurt again when I came back. And the whole first year I was there, I was basically an injured reserve. And I was the first starter in NFL history to be injured reserve twice in one season. And just that, it's hard to develop all that when you're hurt.
I can't remember when you were in Carolina or KC that one year. Were there any big free agent signings when you were in Carolina that like you were a part of the fabric of the locker room and you watched a big name guy come in? Because they weren't really in that phase of the franchise at that point. Because 2010 was that disaster year. So you might not have even been around somebody like that.
I mean, the only one is Cam when he showed up in 2011. And like, yeah. You know, it was, I mean, his presence was felt right away, right? And we saw how charismatic he was and what he could do in the field. No, we brought in, I mean, I was there always with draft picks. Like I was like, obviously Jeff Otal was drafted the same year I was in Carolina. Mm-hmm. Matt Khalil was drafted in the first round by the Vikings when I was there, the Vikings. And then Fisher was drafted in the first round when I was with Kansas City. And then Eric Flowers was drafted in the first round. So it was like, it was draft picks. It wasn't like free agent guys. It was draft picks that were brought in to play on, especially in the offensive line. As far as like, you know, I came in the same year with like Rashad Jennings, who played for the Giants for 3 years or so. Mm-hmm. But Carolina, we didn't have, you know, we had Pep and he left eventually, and Steve Smith, and you know, he got an extension. Jordan Gross got an extension when I was there, but we didn't bring in anyone. Not really.
What is your favorite Julius Pepper story?
Oh, I got one. You'll like this. So he goes to the Bears in 2010, and
I remember.
And we're playing. Do you remember this play I'm about to say?
I do.
Okay,
I do.
I think I've shared it with you before. So. Our OC is Jeff Davidson, and Jeff says all week we're running a wide receiver screen. And he goes, look, guys, we're not going to run it to Julius Pepper's side. Whatever side he's on, if I call it, Matt Moore will audible out of it, or I'm just not going to call it. And I'm playing right tackle at this point. And because what happens on wide receiver screens, the tackle is one of two things. Either he jumps the defensive end to get his hands down, or he cuts him. Okay. Well, Pepper is, you don't really run and jump. He's just not going to happen. So you cut Pep. And you're not going to cut him. He's too fucking big. Okay? You're not going to cut Julius Peppers. And I'm 6'6". I'm not cutting anyone anyways. So, of course, he calls the play, right, to Julius Peppers' side. I go to cut Peppers. It was actually Clawson. Jimmy Clawson was
yes. Oh, we're going to talk about that in a second, so don't worry.
I go to cut Julius Peppers, and he plays off my cut, hits the ball up in the air, and intercepts it. Well, like I lay on the ground. It's ridiculous. God, he was so good, man. Oh, he was a handful.
I want to say, I think I can comfortably say that you were a part of the ugliest football game I think I've ever seen in my entire life that day. It was
the Bears Panthers. It was like the
Bears Panthers game from 2010. In my opinion, is the worst combined quarterbacking I've ever seen during an NFL game. Okay. I remember where I watched this game. It was so terrible.
Wasn't the Bears quarterback like 5 for 18 or something? Like it was.
So here we go. Todd Collins was the Bears quarterback in that game. He finished 6 of 16 for 32 yards and 4 interceptions. Okay.
And the Bears won, by the way.
The Bears won by 2 touchdowns. Jimmy Clawson. 9 of 22 for 61 yards and an interception. Matt Moore in relief, 5 of 10 with 2 picks on 10 attempts. The Bears scored 23 points in that game, in part because Matt Forte was amazing that day. I remember that. And that Julius Peppers play. 23 points in a game where your quarterbacks combined 8 of 19 for 51 yards and 4 interceptions. It was a truly special time for the Chicago Bears organization and offensive football in general.
Well, yeah, we won 2 games that year. Not a lot of fun to win 2 football games. I got more stories from that year than like any other season I ever played, man. It was we had to try to have as much fun as possible to get through it.
How do you go about that? Is there like little tiny moments of levity? Do you like play more games as like an offensive line room? Like, how do you distract yourself from how terrible that can be?
Well, we still worked our asses off, and we didn't win, but we practiced. I didn't feel like anyone ever packed it in. We played our asses off. We just sucked. I mean, this happens. You have a really bad quarterback and you cut all your veterans, and you just try to have fun every day. I mean, Jordan Gross and Ryan Khalil are like the two best. They kept everything so loose and, you know, made it enjoyable to come to work every day. And, you know, it was a tough year, but a year that, again, like the pranks and the joking. And I think that year, I think they did a prank. It must have been that year. So I had got engaged to my wife, my current wife, my only wife. I don't plan on another one.
I was going to say, do you have more than one?
I only plan to have one. And they made fake wedding invitations and put them on everyone's chair in the facility, including the coaches and like equipment staff. So it was like, you know, Jeffrey Isaiah Schwartz, and they made up my wife's middle name. And they said that I was getting married at Temple Israel in like California and whatnot. And then they spent $1,000, like real actual like invitations. So we were at practice.
That's the thing, is the quality of prank can be pretty high among people with a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. So we were at practice that day, and a bunch of coaches and like staff came up to me were like, hey, I can't attend your wedding, but like, thanks anyways, like, I'll send you a gift. And I was like, it's not a real wedding, guys.
It's and incredible.
Like stuff like that, like just like
it's a really subtle prank, like to make other people think you would be the type of guy that would invite people to your wedding that way is like a really nice little dig at somebody. All right, the last thing I want to talk about before we get out of here, very quickly, I want to know more about your long snapping career. Where did it go awry? How did you get by with only snapping with one hand for that long?
So great question. Yeah. So I snapped in high school. And I did field goal and but never had a bad snap. I was really good at it. And my high school coach, I remember, just told me, when you run down to cover, just make the returner choose a direction. It's like my only thing I had to do. don't make the tackle, just like choose it, like make him run to the sideline, basically. So I had zero tackles. Get to college, and I was good at it. Like I was just, and they were like, all right, well, do you snap two-handed? I go, no, I snap one-handed. And they're like, well,
they made me change that when I was a freshman in high school, by the way. I tried to snap one-handed.
When you snap two-handed, you kind of wrap your hand like around the bottom of the ball, right?
Yeah.
So what I did was when one-handed, you don't. It's almost like you throw the ball. So the ball is almost like you snap it at like an actual center, like kind of like up. So I just put my hand like this, like to kind of like be like, all right, look, guys, my hand's on the ball. Look. In college I was the backup, man. I practiced in practice. Like I remember I had to run down one time and cover. I think it was against Walter Thurman, who played in the NFL for like 6-7 years. I tackled him in practice. And the reason why I tackled him in practice was because he tried to juke me out and I couldn't stop. So I just kept he caught the ball and was like trying to, and I just ran straight forward. I couldn't break down to like so
Luis Mendoza, the Mighty Ducks. Just can't slow down.
Exactly. So, so I did that in college. I never got in the game. Fortunately, Eric Steimer was our snapper for 4 years. And then the NFL, I didn't do it in Carolina. And then I got to Kansas City, and I was, you know, like I was, it's my last year, basically. Like if I didn't play well in Kansas City, I was done. So I told the coach, I was like, hey man, I could snap. You need me to snap? Just like to basically be like, hey, I can help the team out. Right. So I come out early and snap every day. I only ever gone in practice. And then Detroit did a little bit of that. But then in New York and Detroit, I was like emergency center too, which is just the worst ever. So funny, man. I could play guard and tackle and pre-snap. It'd be in my stance and see everything fine. Call the mic out, see the safeties. Everything I have to see. Go to center, man.
You put a ball in your hand, it's over.
I'd freak out. I'd be like, Mike, 54. Is that right? Like, I'm like, if I say guard, I'd be like, 54, Mike, done. Dude, center is a trip. My first time ever, first time ever snapped in practice was with the Giants. I never played center in my career. I wore an actual hard thumb cast on my right thumb because my thumb is bad. I would take it on and off every day. Like it was a slit in it. I take it on and off. So I'm wearing a thumb cast and my fingers are taped, like buddy taped together. So I'm barely holding on to the ball. Okay. So I never take a snap with Eli ever. And Eli like would ride like the center's butt really hard. I have no idea what I'm doing. So I get under there and Eli's like, hike. He's like snatches my ass. And I fumble it. And they're like, get the fuck out of here, Schwartz.
Yeah, that's the best thing to do, to screw it up on the first one.
I wasn't trying to screw up. But like, they like cuss me out. I'm like, what do you want me to do?
You tanked it. I know
you
did.
What do you want me to do? It's my first time ever doing this. Don't cuss me out the first time I ever do it. They're going with me.
I do regret not pursuing my long snapping career.
You should have done it, man.
I'm only like 60% kidding about it. So this is what happened. So very quickly, nobody cares about this. So I was really good at it, like legitimately good at it. I went to a camp between my junior and senior year of high school. It was like a regional like recruiting camp for kickers and punters and long snappers. And I won the camp, whatever that means. But like the long snapper for Virginia Tech was one of the counselors, the long snapper for the Colts. Everyone there was like, you know, just send tapes, you know, you'll do it, whatever. So I was fully ready to try to like be a Division I long snapper. And then my senior year, I started on offense and defense, which didn't happen at my high school. I was the first guy in like six years.
We had 18 players. We basically had everyone play both ways.
We had 115 guys on the team. So no one ever played both ways. So I, but they had me play both ways, and they were just like, the junior long snapper is pretty good. We you can't be on every special team and play offense and defense. So they just took me off the punt team. So I just never got to do it, and that was it.
When you didn't like that fight for it, you weren't like, I want a long snap.
I literally was trying to take one for the team, like, and I was just trying to do the best. I was the captain. I just felt it was the best thing for everybody. So I just didn't do it. I still to this day, it is the skill that I have. Like, compared to the general population, it might be the thing that I was best at in my entire life. Like, not a joke.
It's a good skill to have. I mean, you know, I don't know if you have kids. Like, that's my son's.
I certainly don't.
My son's a little scrawny kid. I mean, maybe he's tall, very tall. Maybe I'll get him to long snapping too.
That's what you got to do. That's the move. Either golf and long snapping is going to be a great combination.
The Panthers just re-signed JJ Jansen again. You know, I think he came in 2010, maybe. I mean, he's made it like $1 million a year. For like 12 years.
It's the move. When I have a kid, if I have a kid, that will be the first thing I do. It's like, all right, here you do. This is how you do this. All right. Jeff Schwartz, thank you very much, buddy. It's always good to talk to you. Great to get your insight. I really appreciate it. I'm sure we'll do this again.
All right. Sounds good, bud. Take care.
All right, guys. That's all we got for today. Thank you so much to Jeff Schwartz for stopping by. Thank you to Lindsey Jones for recapping day one of the tampering period. We will be back tomorrow with Nate to do something similar. We're going to hit everything that happens on day two. It's going to be really wild. I'm very excited about it. Until then, please rate and review the podcast on your podcast platform of choice. Really appreciate that. Also, please subscribe to The Athletic. We have tons of good stuff coming. It's $1 a month right now. athletic.com/football show. Please check that out. We'll be back tomorrow. I'll talk to you guys soon.
This was The Athletic Football Show.